Our four-season weather here in the Inland Northwest places extra demands on your roof. What might pass as a good roof in some cities just won't hold up around here. That's why you should hire Barton Roofing for your next roof. Free estimates, written proposals, a member of the Spokane Home Builders Association, and accredited by the Better Business Bureau. BartonRoof.com.
Much of what you hear today on the radio is for the birds. Remember when you used to listen to the radio for the records? Your radio is back the way it used to be. It's For the Records with Spokane Gary.
It's the Gary Show For the Records, a train wreck you can listen to. Oh, this just in. The Price is Right spokesmodels are urging CBS to have Bob Barker spayed and neutered.
Studies have shown that this show's listeners are happier, have fewer cavities, and less therapy.
What about my therapy? Hey, let's get under the weather with Wendy McLeod. What do you got, Wendy?
Weather will be scattered throughout our region with a variety of conditions predicted for the five-day forecast. Varying temperatures will contribute to a cooling and warming trend that will blanket our entire listening area until the change is underway. Back to you, Gary.
I'm just curious. Did you actually say anything?
No, I'm just foxy that way.
You are. We have a couple guests in our program today who are obviously not familiar with our show. I'd like to welcome Tim and Becky Hattenberg. They penned a new book just out called Death Ride, A Little Boy's Night of Terror. Maybe you've seen the article in Current Magazine. Welcome, Tim and Becky, to our show. Tell us about your book there. It takes place in Columbus, Montana, was it?
Yes, it's a story about a little boy that survived the tragic murder of his parents in 1937, Eastern Montana in Columbus, Montana. Larry lives in North Spokane near Franklin Park. He's now 84 years of age. He's a father-in-law, one of my former students. I'm a retired history teacher. And one of my students called me a few years ago and said, you have to meet my father-in-law. You can't believe what he went through. He never talked about it till about 10 years ago. His own family didn't know the events that actually happened. They knew their grandparents died tragically, but not the details.
And you've been working on the book for how long?
Over 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the you were just initially intrigued with the story, and you followed up with it with an interview. Larry Kuntz was his name?
Yes, Larry Kuntz. In fact, I've done research for Tony and Susan Bamonte for over 12 years, and so I kind of had
Does
a leg up.
Does he pay well?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it kind of does at times if you're really nice to him. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had a leg up on the research from the crime scene type of things and what to look for, and I was really intrigued by some other events that took place actually 27 years before the event in 1937 in Upper State New York. And I took it to Tony and sought advice from him about having it written by him or someone else, and he came back to my wife Becky and I and said, you two ought to be doing the writing, you're already doing the research. So that's how we started.
Mm-hmm. Becky, your take?
Well, we really enjoyed getting to know Larry and his family and his lovely wife Janet, and they were so open and honest with us and gave us a lot of inside information that had never been in print before. So we felt like this book really opened up the story and all the facts were out there. And when we asked Larry about writing his story, he said he would let us go for it as long as all the truth was told and that his parents weren't just the victims, that they were real people that really suffered at the hands of Frank Robidoux, the murderer. And we tried to do that and make a really good family history for Larry's family and tell the truth about what Frank Robidoux was really like.
And without spoiling the book, tell us a little bit about it. I read snippets about it the other day, and give us a little Reader's Digest version.
Larry Kuntz's father was a grain elevator operator in Wheat Basin, Montana. The town no longer exists. We have photos in the book, excellent photos, and he was accosted by Frank Robidoux over some grain payments that he said he owed him. It was during the Great Depression, so a lot of people were hurting in the area. They had a lot of droughts, so people were desperate, but he was a different kind of character altogether. He was an escaped convict, had murdered before, and ended up in Montana 15 years after escaping from prison in Upper State New York, and eventually forced Larry's father to write some checks at gunpoint, and then later on went to their home, took him out to the car for fear that Larry's father was going to go to the nearby town of Columbus, 26 miles away, to seek out help from the sheriff. And the murders took place on a desolate, isolated road in the middle of the night the day after Thanksgiving in 1937.
Did you visit all these sites? Did Mr. Kuntz go with you?
Mr. Kuntz was there this last spring. He was there. He was there 10 years ago. Becky and I were both there twice in the last 2 years. We went to the sites where the actual killings took place in the town itself. Columbus is still was where the county jail is today, and the also where the hanging took place at some point. We were there 6 weeks ago. We had quite a turnout so in the town.
And this was for the debut of your book?
It was for the unveiling of the new hanging and killing exhibit in their museum. And they wanted us to be a part of that with our book. So we did a presentation for the town. Over 200 people showed up, and some as far away as Wyoming came, even from Western Washington, flew over there. So we felt really honored. And then we had a book signing in the museum and sold over 200 books in that short time period.
So
we had to ship another 96 over.
Oh, good for you. Now, I misunderstood. Now, I thought that Mr. Robidoux was his name. I thought that he was an adjacent landowner or something.
He was a tenant farmer.
Oh,
in the area,
okay.
Yes, and
okay.
He had come out. No one in the area knew about his past. he had moved, and we did a lot of research and found out that after he escaped from prison 15 years before the murders, he'd gone from New York as far west as California, and we traced his pattern throughout the country, and he obviously went on the railroad lines, hitching rides as he went. He changed his name more than a few times. One real intriguing part of the book is the hanging invitations were sent out by the sheriff, which was the norm then. The sheriff, their job was to send out invitations. And a police officer from San Bernardino, California, represented their police department and they requested an invitation. So he traveled over 5,000 miles round trip in the dead of winter to witness the hanging, which only tells us that they were probably had a cold case that he was involved in there. He also had, there was two officers in Wyoming, as Becky mentioned, people in Wyoming were there, requested invitations where he went by the name of Frank Johnson before he changed his name. So his patterns and his trail of escape and exodus from the police forces throughout the country shows that he probably was a type of serial killer.
And the murder took place how, again? For our listeners.
Go ahead.
He took the family on what we called the death ride. He held them at gunpoint, took them out into a desolate area. He shot Larry's dad, Mike Kuntz, in the back of the head immediately. And then his mother fought with the killer, which caused him to use up the rest of his bullets. His last bullet was the one that killed her. So she actually saved her little boy's life by causing the killer to use up his bullets. Then the killer, Frank Robidoux, beat Larry with the butt of his gun and thought he had killed him. But Larry survived the beating and recuperated enough to finger Frank Robidoux as the murderer of his parents and help the police investigators to bring him to justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is intriguing. We're going to go ahead and take a break, and we'll be right back.
Congratulations! You found where Spokane talks online. Tell your friends.
Affordable health coverage is now available in Washington State. Better Health Together is a nonprofit organization offering free one-on-one assistance to help you explore your options, understand discounts and tax credits, and apply for coverage. We have 250 trained professionals throughout Eastern Washington ready to help you apply for coverage. To learn more about this free service and your insurance options, call Better Health Together at 509-321-7500. 509-321-7500.
Hi, this is Kent Adams, co-host of Business Talks. I'd like to introduce you to a couple of friends, Lisa and Alan Gwaltney of Window World. I've known Lisa and Alan for a number of years and know them to be honest and caring folks. They take pride in their windows, sliding doors, and blinds. So when it comes to your home, call them direct at 509-456-5880. That's Window World of Spokane and Coeur d'Alene. And if you tell them Kent sent me, they'll give you 5% off a five-window installation. Call them today at 456-5880.
Well, it's time. We're back again. Spokane Gary for the records. And here's news you can't use with Howard Whittington. Howie, baby, give it to us.
From Washington, Congress today accused major airline carriers of violating antitrust laws in pricing and customer seat preference. Ramifications from this action are not expected to affect Gold Card members, Sky High Club members, 75K frequent flyers, customers traveling with small children, two strollers, one car seat, and an enormous stuffed animal, customers needing assistance, platinum card holders, customers whose maiden name began with J, active members of police or firefighters, people sitting in an exit row who can't lift the door, flyers from partner airlines, or old people who insist on taking their coat or sweater off slowly in the airplane aisle with 70 people lined up behind them. And finally, you. This is day 24,094 of the North-South Freeway Project. I'm Howard Whittington, and this news is a service of Jennings Funeral Home.
Jennings Funeral Home wants to let you know about our upcoming fire sale. Every once in a while, a cremation gets out of hand, and we pass those savings on to you. Smoke-damaged clothing, jewelry, dentures, uppers and lowers, and suits with just a slit up the back to be repaired are all 70% off any retail outlet. And don't forget, we're now open till 1 a.m. in three of our locations. Wendy, what do you got for our short-range weather prognostication?
Just a minute. Okay, heads, I say rain like a cow peeing on a flat rock.
That's my girl. Now, if you're just joining us, well, you're officially late. We started 15 minutes ago. We have with us Tim and Becky Hattenberg. They're discussing their book, Death Ride, A Little Boy's Night of Terror. Tim and Becky, we were right in the middle of talking about the young boy who was affected by this murder. And tell us more.
The inspiring part of our book is how Larry turned out. He honestly could have held a lot of anger inside, but being having been brought up by a loving family, his grandmother raised him along with an uncle and his family, and he said that the love that he had from his family honestly helped him to get through the hard times. And at about age 12, he decided being angry wasn't going to work for him, so he forgave Frank Robidoux and what he did to them. And he grew up to become a pharmacist, and he was a pharmacist for 54 years in the Spokane area, so a lot of people knew him from that. So he's very inspiring that bad things happen, but you have to make your life good in spite of it.
How much time went from the actual crime to the hanging till he got closure?
The hanging itself took place in January, and the murders took place in the end of November, so it was a relatively short period of time, especially compared to today. And then as far as closure, Larry had moved back to North Dakota with his family, and he shared with us that he had nightmares for many years. People even had to sit on him and hold him down. And he told us that he would walk down the streets of Richardson, North Dakota, and he'd hear people say, "There's that poor little boy." And he says, "I don't want to be the poor little boy anymore. I just want to be normal." So he's just a remarkable person to meet.
Did law enforcement have any idea how many this Robidoux had killed prior?
They knew. They found out about two previous murders in New York. He was a suspect in another case. There was a cab driver in Billings, Montana that was murdered a few years before these murders, which was never solved. But it was also the same caliber of bullet that was used that he had. He came home and told one of his, a person that was a farmer in the area, he was an employee of theirs, and said that he had to walk home in the middle of the night because he was all muddy and everything, but he claimed he walked 35 miles in one night from Billings because he was kicked out of a car that he'd hitched a ride on, yet they found the body. I'm going to relook at and see what that, because it sounds obviously that, you know, he was in the area. He told the person he was in their area. So
So explain for us again, how many years did Larry kind of keep this under his hat, and how did you then discover the story and then decide to develop it?
He kept this story buried deep in his soul from the time he was 5 years old until he was about 75. It was just the way it was at that time. People did not talk about it at all because they didn't want to upset him. So nobody talked about it. Even his wife, one time when they were still dating, asked him what is about his family, and he told her that they had been murdered, and she said, "Do you remember it?" And he said, "Yes, like it was yesterday." So she never asked him about it again. So it was just a few years ago that he even started talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're excited to see how the new book does. We're glad to see some results from your hard work. And now you're working on another one. This is something that happened about 1959. This is kind of something that maybe shook Spokane out of its innocence. And this is the Candy Rogers case. And can you tell us a little bit about maybe some that are not, you know, are new to the area and knew nothing about this?
I'd be glad to. The murder of Candy Rogers took place in 1959. Candy was a 9-year-old, beautiful, blonde-eyed girl. Blue-eyed, blonde girl. I don't know what I just said. But anyway, she was smart. She was very well-liked in her school. She was in the fourth grade. And she was also in Campfire Girls. And it was time to sell Campfire Girl mints, and she went out to sell mints and never returned home. And when she didn't come home at the appropriate time, her mother called the police and reported her missing, which started a huge manhunt for her. Every available policeman, fireman, sheriff's department, and thousands of volunteers were all looking for her.
I was 6 years old at the time. I lived in North Spokane, not far from where Candy Rogers lived. My older sister was a Campfire Girl, and I remember, I'm from a large family, she was not allowed to go out selling mints without two of my older brothers accompanying her during the daylight hours. There was even a time where the Campfire Girl councils were deciding to suspend all sales. It was nationwide news. Anyone, I'm 62 and I was 6 years old at the time, anyone my age or older, if you talk about Candy Rogers and they lived here, they know exactly what you're talking about. Becky and I were doing some research at the library just a few weeks ago, and somebody was looking at one of the machines, we were printing something, they go, oh, the Candy Rogers story. I mean, it's amazing. It's a real tragic, sad story to say the least. It's difficult to work on, however, with Becky's help, she's convinced me that we need to bring some closure for the poor little girl, and it's just... It's hard to do, but there's still, it was never solved.
She disappeared on the northwest section of town, correct? And what street was last seen?
She lived on West Mission, and she was last seen in that area. She had promised her mom that she would stay right in the neighborhood and sell the mints there. So the last time she was seen was right in that area, and the mints that she had been selling, they found later that night below the bridge at Pettit Drive, which is known now as Doomsday Hill. And her body was found 12 days later, way out by north of the airport.
So... In your efforts to research this upcoming book, what sort of resources do you have at your fingertips for researching all of this?
Right now, we've interviewed a policeman that was active on duty at the time. We interviewed the motorcycle repairman for the police department.
This is Dan Height?
Dan yes. Height, mm-hmm. Yes. And he gave us some information. We still have a long ways to go. We've just really gotten started. I'm kind of hitting dead ends as far as finding any relatives of Candy Rogers. So if anybody out there knows anybody, we would be very welcome to have that information.
And through your research, are you satisfied that maybe they have come to the proper conclusion of who the murderer is? I don't want to give away your book yet either.
No. In fact, there were three prime suspects, and the biggest question now is there's also a former officer, Glenn Whiteley. I believe he's in about 93 years of age. One, he has a prime suspect. Dan Height has his prime suspect, and the police department has one. And if you look at the information we have now, they're all... could have been incredible people that would have done it. You could see that they would be on the list. They haven't found anything definitive, though, of those that would point that out. They've all deceased. One suspect, for example, 10 months after they found the body of Candy Rogers, he was arrested and charged with child molestation. In fact, he had raped his 7-year-old daughter. When he was arrested for that and taken to jail, he committed suicide that evening. And at first he tried to slash his wrists and then wrote on the wall of the jail cell, "I have sinned against the Lord." Then he hanged himself from the bunk. When the officer went to tell his wife about him being arrested, the first thing she said to him wasn't about him being arrested. She goes, "He killed Candy Rogers, didn't he?" So she knew what his his behavior was. So that's why he was a prime suspect. He is buried at Riverside Park, and there's never been a DNA test on him. So there's some people involved in the case still that would like to see that happen. The other one died in Minnesota, recently. He did have a DNA test. Morse was his name, and it didn't match. He also passed two lie detector tests, but if you look at his criminal patterns, that's not surprising that his sociopath mentality, that he could probably do so. So it's an open case still.
Mm-hmm. May I ask, how did this research affect you two personally?
It's really hard. When we did the book Death Ride, we felt like we were living the story for like 2 years. And sometimes it was really so emotional that we'd have to take a little break from it. We'd have to just set it down and go for a walk or something, because it does. It gets in your, not only your mind, but in your heart. And to do it right, I guess that's how you have to do it. And same with this Candy Rogers one. I think with Death Ride, it was a little bit more inspiring because Larry survived. With Candy Rogers, there was no survivor and there was no justice for her.
Well, how can we get a copy of your book? Where can we get that? What's your website? How can we learn more?
Our website is deathridemurder.com, and you can order it on there. It's also available in all the local Hastings stores, at Auntie's Bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and we're on Amazon.com.
Very good. Well, thanks for joining us, Tim and Becky. And join us again next week when we'll have Tony Bamonte, another local historian and book publisher, on. The Spokane Gary Show has been brought to you by American Aggravated Discount Airlines. We make driving more appealing.
Records is produced in Spokane, Washington by SpokaneTalksOnline.com, which is solely responsible for its content. Ask a question, recommend a guest, and hear this program again online anytime at SpokaneTalksOnline.com. Next time you turn on your radio, make sure it's for the records. Thanks for listening.
To help you be safe, Washington state law requires you to call 811 two full business days before you plan, for example, to dig, drill, plow, pull from, or pound anything into the ground. Be prepared to provide the operator with the correct address, cross street, and the description of your work. You must mark the dig area with white paint. The operator will inform you of the utilities notified of your impending excavation. Wait for all their marks. Be safe and dig with care.